Welcome back to another episode of the Stag Raw Podcast. This is episode 315. And before we get into it, I just want to shout out to the couple of subscribers to the newsletter of late. We managed to punch out a couple of those in the start of the year, and it's good to see that the numbers of subscribers to that are growing. It's just a cheeky newsletter of some of the things that I've been up to and some of the products and things that I've been using that you might like to use yourself. So if you'd like to subscribe to that, the link is the first link there in the show notes. Anyway, we are massively privileged to have Michael Brake on the podcast. Michael was part of the New Zealand Men's Eight at the Tokyo Olympics, of course delayed a year to 2021. If you want to know a little bit more about their story, I've added the links to a couple of awesome YouTube videos. One of them is a speech by Sean Kirkham, another member of the Eight. He was a member of that Eight for, I think, 10 years, something like that. And the other one is a story which Michael and Sean are both a part of, is about Tony O'Connor, the coach of the Eight. No relation, although he's Irish. My heritage is Irish, so maybe we are, but highly doubt it. So the links to those are in the show notes. Michael's had a massive journey in high-performance sport. He went to Bulgaria with my old man, actually, separate crews, but back in the day, and had early victory. And then it's just that painstaking, massive commitment year after year. Another sort of 10 or 11 years for that one moment, that Olympic gold at Tokyo. So hell of a story, hell of a man, and he's not done yet. Exciting stuff to come from Michael Brake, so make sure you're following him on Instagram. As he says, he's hoping to get out there and talk a bit more, so if you're someone that is looking for a speaker after this, he'd be a good person to book for your function. Right, without further ado, let's get into this episode. Awesome one with Michael Brake.
I've been out probably 5 or 6 times in the last couple of months and haven't seen a single thing. And in areas where in the past I've always seen something, you know?
Yeah.
And I've just felt so robbed because every time I've taken someone as well, I've been like, man, this spot's so good. And then they're like, oh yeah, man.
To farms or what?
It's all farms.
Yeah. That's the where you want to go. Should we just kick into it and be recording?
Yeah, sweet.
Yeah, that's where you want to take someone, eh? Like, my stepdaughter wants to go hunting this year, and I'm like, oh, they know some farmers. Don't want to take her for a walk. Even going rabbit shooting or something would be good. Yeah.
You just want something with a ridge that you can just drive up to and pop over and have a look down?
Well, near where Paddy McInnes, his old man is, my mate.
That's how.
Yeah, in Hawke's Bay. My mate has a neighbouring farm, and yeah, there's good deer numbers in there.
There's heaps down there. Every time I ask Paddy how's dad's doing, he goes, oh yeah. Dad said there's heaps of deer out at the moment.
Oh, I'm devastated. I recorded a podcast with Paddy a couple of months ago before he went back to Ireland.
Oh yeah.
Nice 2-hour conversation. It was like logged and everything, and I was like, oh sweet, bloody brilliant.
Yeah.
Then I went to upload it, and there's just no sound. Like, said there was sound, but there's just no sound came back, so. That was devastating.
Gutted. He's always got a good story.
Oh, yeah, like I said, we yarned for ages. We talked about his car tour that he did through bloody
Mongol Rally.
Yeah, the Mongol Rally.
You could do 2 hours on that from some of the stories I've heard, but
yeah,
I don't know how many you'd want to hear on a podcast.
Yeah, and then him and the Irishman, yeah, that was good stuff. Yeah. Did you train with the Irish fellas?
Gary and Paul.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. When they were over in New Zealand, both of them plus 2 other guys came over.
Yeah,
there was 4 of them. They were over for a season, and that was good fun. Trained with them alongside them, kind of on Karapiro, and then Gary came back the year after.
Mint.
But broke his arm.
Oh shit!
Yeah, it was a bummer. I think a couple of weeks in, he come off his bike and then he was in a foreign country with a broken arm. Going, oh, yeah. Geez, what am I doing here? So, yeah, a bit of a sad ending, that one.
That's good segue. But how did you break your wrist?
How did I break mine? So the first injury, the first serious injury for my wrist was, it was 3 days back into training after we got back from the Rio Olympics.
Yeah.
So with the rowing team, we usually have about 3 weeks off after a world champ, so it's just enough time to kind of you know, mentally refresh and then come back ready to get going again.
Mm-hmm.
But after the Olympics, you get 3 months.
Nice.
Because so we kind of, with rowing, it is very heavily oriented towards the Olympics. You're focusing on that throughout a 4-year cycle, and so you kind of build, and then the Olympics happens, and you, at that point, you've usually had a pretty intense year leading into it, so they give you a lot of time off, which is great.
So, just on that, what does it mean to be world champion?
I'm actually not a world champion. I was going to say,
you've got yeah. Silver.
How did that feel
being silver?
Well, it feels good.
Yeah.
I guess.
Did you sort of compartmentalize it as like you got the job done, you qualified the boat?
We qualified the boat before the final. So right. we qualified the boat in our semi-final. So, yeah, with that world champs event that we got the silver at, that was also, like you say, a qualification regatta for the Olympics. By making it into the final, mm-hmm. we'd qualified it for the Olympics. So the job was done before the final. And what we saw in the quarters and the semis was some of the tightest racing that I've ever done in my life. It was the quarterfinal. It was between first and fourth, with first through to third getting through, and fourth and sixth being knocked out. First to fourth, it was a 2-second difference over a 6-minute race, mm-hmm. and then in the semi-final, I think it was a 0.5 second between first and fourth.
Shit.
Yeah, and then when it got to the final, there was like 4 or 5 seconds between each boat, so it was like first, and then 4 seconds to us, and then another few seconds to third, and it completely spread out. So
yeah.
I think everyone was doing the same thing. They were just absolutely redlining to try and get that Olympic qualification. And then kind of come off a wee bit. But getting the silver was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
My story was similar to a lot of the guys around that time, where there was a bit of early success with some age group events. So in 2012, I went overseas with a good group of guys, and we won the juniors. That was our first time traveling, and we won that. And so early success was great. It got me hooked, but it became quite hard to replicate.
Mm.
That's my only world title, world championship title, was mm-hmm. under-19s, because we then went on to under-23s and got a silver, which was also, you know, a great result. But then it was a bunch of, you know, at best thirds at World Cups, and then we got a lot of sixth places, which in rowing is last in the A final.
Yeah.
So you're the worst of the best. And then, yeah, so to get back on the podium at the World Champs, or to get on the podium at the World Champs, was awesome.
Good feeling again.
It was a very good feeling. Yeah, it was. Yeah, like any high level sport, it's just a sign that the systems that you got in place and your processes are paying off.
So 3 years back, you're getting a 3-month break.
Yeah, we're getting, yeah, so after Rio, 3-month break, and then 3 days, everything happened in threes around that time.
Mm-hmm.
3-month break, and then 3 days in, we were just finishing off a row. I was rowing with Sean Kirkham. He's a good mate, and I'm sure we might touch on him a bit later. We're doing a bit more in rowing. We're both coming out of retirement somewhat, which we can talk about later.
Yeah.
We were out in a pier, and we did a little exercise 100 metres from the pontoon. So we'd just done an hour and a half row. It's about 16 kilometres, and we're 100 metres out, and we're just doing a little technical exercise that is incredibly light and shouldn't do anything. You know, shouldn't be high risk at all. And I just ended up having a bit of a freak tweak of my wrist. I thought, that's weird. Went in, and it was completely inflamed. It ended up being de Kuyvens. It's intersection tendonitis. So it was the start of a tendonitis anyway, and I didn't rest adequately, and so that just continued the inflammation process, and and basically that stopped me from in rowing, it's feathering and squaring the wrist, so turning the wrist to turn the blade from the position that it goes into the water to the position that it's in when it's out of the water. It does that twist and turn with each stroke. So I couldn't do that. I was in and out of the boat with that. It wasn't a straightforward process.
Could you run the other side or no?
I couldn't run the other side. No. It'd be like learning to run backwards. It takes, at that level, usually a good rower over a year to transition properly, or at least a season, so 6 months. My wrist was still buggered.
Yeah.
So it took a month or so to get back in the boat. And then as soon as I got back in the boat, I think it might have been the same row, or it might have been three rows later. Everything was happening in threes around then. And I did my other wrist, same thing. And that kind of came down to I'd now not done anything for a month, rowing related. I'd been on the bike doing cross training the whole time. So then jumping back in the boat and trying to go straight to full volume, having not done any build up with my forearms and wrists, and so I blew out the other one.
There was nothing else around it, like stress or
No, you were feeling pretty good. I was feeling fine. I just probably pushed the pace a bit hard coming back from a break, from an even longer break, a 4 month break, really off using the wrist. So I was out with that wrist, and it took about 6 months because you don't always go for, in sport you try and take the least invasive path for coming back from an injury. So initially it was rest, and then it was anti-inflammatories, and then it was a cortisone, and each time I'm taking a bit of time to do that process, and then trying to come back and go, okay, no, it's bad. So
are you dealing with sports doctor, or are you going to like a wrist specialist as well?
Started just trying to go physio. Started with just physio, and then from there it was, you know, we need the doctor's help, and then from there I ended up with both of them getting surgery on them. And it was a relatively simple surgery. We ended up going private to speed it up.
Do you know what they did?
Yeah, they get in and they cut the cause of that injury is you get scar tissue under the fascia around the tendon, and so every time you move it, that injury is known for creaking because you've got scar tissue inside the fascia that's rubbing. That's my understanding anyway.
Yeah, sounds like something that caused a problem.
So they just get in and they cut the fascia and then they take out the scar tissue, and when I don't know if it joins back up or whatever, but you, when you've had the surgery, it's meant to be, you're done. You're in the clear.
Yeah.
Go on, and you shouldn't be able to get the injury again. And so I had the surgery 3 days after we decided, so it was quite a quick path to treatment. And then as soon as the wounds had closed over, so I wasn't at risk of infection, I could row again and there was no issues. So it was like, once we finally got to that step of having surgery, about 10 days later, I was back to full capacity. But a frustrating journey to get there.
And so I was reading the adventure frustration, you did like 450Ks on like a watt bike or some crazy shit.
All I could do was ride. And I was determined not to come back unfit, so I thought, shit. What I worked out was that because I was training on my own, I didn't have to.
Were you part of the team still?
I was still part of the team, and I was quite lucky to be looked after by the team and not just be
cast aside,
which can happen in some situations in some teams. But I was looked after well, and you know, reassured that I'd get my shot when the body was good. I worked out though with kind of being on the side on my own and doing my own program. I thought, I better find a silver lining to this. And my silver lining was that I didn't have to taper for these little selection events that everyone else had to go through, because I was kind of on my own recovery path at this point. And so not needing to freshen up every 3-4 weeks whatever for an erg test or for a 2K race, I could just put myself further and further in the hole to then pop up.
Hopefully, so did you stay with the physiologist?
I worked with the physiologist on this, and I was on my own program But I was kind of, I guess I was testing my own limits of overtraining on the bike, and it ended up working. After 6 months on the bike, you know, I did some pretty nasty sessions that year. The following year, which I guess we'll get to in a second, spent that on the bike as well, and pushed it even more, but ended up coming back quite fitter than I thought I was going to be, I guess, and earned a seat straight into the men's eight for world champs. Missed all the world cups with injury, and then came into the men's eight and was actually quite fit, so managed to pull a positive out of that situation, being on the bike for 6 months.
What did you track? Like, as you say, you do massive volume over and over again, and you start feeling like pretty like knackered because you just want to be able to, as you say, taper it off and get back to pushing it out. But like, what did you track over that time? Just watts or outputs or?
Day by day, it was tracking watts.
Yeah.
I might get this dog collected. Eh? She's
wants to play.
She wants to play. Yeah. She's saying, "Who's this? Someone fun in the house. Throw the ball." So yeah, I mean, on each session we'd track. It'd be a lot of the training I was doing was low intensity. It was mm-hmm. you can't get through on some of the bigger days. You know,
was zone two talked about back then or no?
Yeah, we had what we call it. We had it U3, utilization 3 was what we used, and that was our low zone. U2, and then we'd have like threshold, and then you know, some max stuff as well, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea behind doing the extra volume was that I didn't have a heck of a lot of intensity. It was building up threshold, but it was more just mind numbing, banging your head against a wall. You know, your session for today is 4 hours.
Oof.
Oh, sweet.
Could you still weight train or no?
Yeah, I still did weight training. Yep, still did full lower body weight training, so leg press. So I still held a good bit of strength. All the upper body strength was gone.
Mm.
That was the hardest thing to bring back.
Could you hold a barbell and squat or no?
We did try that. What do we do? We did try back squats, but I felt quite uneasy because I couldn't really hold it with one hand. Depending on the hand as well.
Yeah.
I remember having strength and conditioning coaches holding it on my back, but it just got a bit dodgy because
it became like a intensive resource. Like you three people come help me.
Yeah, I was sucking all of the.
You're supposed to be training by yourself.
All of the resources out of everyone in the building. Yeah. But yeah, it wasn't actually like I obviously didn't do any. I didn't do a lot of rowing movement.
Mm-hmm.
But luckily for me as a rower, the cycling movement hits
mm-hmm.
most of the key muscles anyway.
Did you set any sort of external goals? Or? They'd given you a set time frame, and
yeah,
you knew
yeah,
you were going to be back then.
They'd given me a pretty clear once we decided that, or once it looked like we were going down the surgery route, we set a pretty clear time frame and kind of knew that it was going to be a couple of months. But
yeah,
while we were getting to that point, it was kind of every 2 weeks we go, okay, we'll take it by the next 2 weeks, and that was probably the most infuriating was going fortnightly somewhat.
Yeah.
Not knowing whether when we got there it would actually be good to go.
And how did you measure good to go? Did you have some sort of metric with that?
We use the rowing machine most of the time. So yeah. Rather than, I'd do a 20-minute session on the rowing machine and see if I felt it on my wrists. And
yeah.
Most times it was, it's still causing pain. Sweet. And so
and that's not even feathering
now. And it's just flat wrist.
Yeah.
And it's just flat wrist. So it was literally just the load through the forearms mm-hmm. on the tendons. Is that still hurting? Yes, it's still hurting. Cool. Two more weeks of biking.
Fuck.
Yeah. So it would come down every 2 weeks to doing 20 minutes on the rowing machine. Nope, it still hurts. Cool, that's two more weeks on the bike now. Yeah.
Oh dear.
Yeah. It was that was brutal.
Yeah.
The next year I did another wrist injury, but that was a much clearer. It's going to take 3 months to recover, and mm-hmm. so I was like, okay, cool. We can plan for that now. We can create a 3 month program.
Because you broke it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah.
What were you doing?
I was cleaning gutters.
Yeah.
And I fell off a roof, basically.
Paid for cleaning gutters?
Nah.
No, fuck.
It was just for my parents. I was helping out with one of their rental properties.
Oh dear.
So I mean that happened the next year. So yeah, got through the 6 months with the tendonitis. Got in the men's eight. We got sixth. Like I mentioned, we had quite a few sixth places, which was the same as our result from Rio the year before. So
yeah, you held steady at that stage.
We were consistent.
Yeah.
You get points for consistency. So we got sixth. We came back into our off season, the NZ summer. I had a good summer. Was selected for the men's pair.
Yeah.
This was two seasons after Hamish and Eric retired. Mm-hmm. There are two guys that had done the pair the year before, and the stroke sider, which was the side that I rode on out to the right hand side, he decided he'd had enough, so he was retiring. And so there was an opening there, which...
Who was that?
It was Jamie Hunter. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. So Tom Murray was in the pair with Jamie Hunter, and Tom was one of the guys in my junior four and also in the Rio 8. And so I'd rode with him quite a bit, and we did the pair in the off season.
Was he North Shore too?
No, he was Melbourne Boys.
Right.
Yeah, he's still on the team as well. He's had a very long rowing career. Yeah, yeah. And still going, obviously.
Yeah.
But we jumped in the pair. It went quite well. We got selected for the pair for that season, which I was incredibly excited about.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, 3 days after that selection was when I fell off the roof.
Three again.
Yeah, I was not enjoying the number three over those couple of years. And I was just cleaning some gutters for my parents at their rental property. I can't sit still. That's just me in general. I've always got to have something going on, and that was a bit of, you know, it didn't help me a lot in sport because you need to rest a lot when you're excited that much. But I was cleaning gutters, and I'd had a ladder on the end of a pergola. That was how I got up onto the roof, and I was coming down the pergola, and the nails that were holding the bit of timber that I was on at that point in time, the nails just pulled out, and I fell with the section of the pergola that I was on. So I fell.
It fell under you, though.
It fell under me, and I fell 3 meters and landed.
Ooh, that's high enough, isn't it?
Landed in a seated position on my wrist, and it was a Colles fracture. So that was just the whole tip of the radius had just basically splintered into bits.
Yeah.
I don't know how bad it was. I knew that it hurt a hell of a lot because by the time I got to the hospital with my mate driving,
someone was there with you.
Yeah, he was there with me. Yeah. Insult to injury, I landed in a recycling bin. So I landed in a recycling bin with my hand on the ground. Yeah, I had a cut ass and a broken wrist. So we got to hospital. I was just soaked in sweat. It was the most nasty experience. It was the most pain I've ever experienced.
Did you ambulance here, or he drove you?
No, he drove me there. Yeah.
Did you take anything?
Not until I got to hospital.
Holy heck!
Yeah. So we drove Cambridge to Hamilton, and
oh my god,
we did it faster than Google Maps said that we were going to do it, because my mate was looking at me going, holy heck. Anyway, we got there, and I remember just being, because I was still, you know, I wanted to be in this pair, I remember being like, oh, you know,
it'll be all right.
Will I be, is it just like, it's just dislocated, we'll put it back and I'll be back in 2 weeks, and they're like, nah.
Do you remember what it looked like to
it was,
you?
It was messy. Yeah, I didn't compound, it didn't break skin, but
yeah.
It was all out of shape because I'd landed like that and crushed the joint. My hand was kind of in the wrist a wee bit.
Mm-hmm.
It had kind of sunk in a couple of centimeters.
Oh my god!
And then it was out of shape, and the fingers, because all of the muscles that come over the wrist into the fingers had kind of just slipped through the joint, and it was, the fingers were all messy and not opening properly, and yeah, and so
did they put you under first? Some surgery?
They put me under for surgery, yeah. They definitely did. But the first thing they did was they pulled the wrist out of the joint. And so they gave me morphine, so I didn't feel a thing. And one doctor was hooked around here, pulling...
Were they able to block you or not? Just morphine and go?
They just morphine. I didn't feel any of it.
Yeah.
It was obviously... So it was no pain, but it was disgusting because... Because there was one... You know, they got the two... What, looked like the two biggest male nurses or doctors in the ward, and one was hooked around my arm, so I was like this, I was sitting like this trying not to look at it.
And you've probably got bigger arms than most people coming with this.
They were bigger than they are now that I'm retired, but one was hooked around here, and he was just leaning back.
Yeah.
And the other had two hands on my wrist that was bent like that, and he was pulling it out.
Oh my god.
And I just was sitting there like, oh, thinking there's at least 100-150 force going through my broken wrist right now. And I remember being so pale. My mate took a video and I looked so pale, but they pulled it out and then bent it down so that the hand couldn't go back in, and I stayed in the cast. Once it was at that point, there was no rush and it wasn't life threatening, so I ended up staying in a cast for, I think it was about 3 days before I got in for surgery.
Mm-hmm.
But the doc said, he's like, you're not going to row again. He said, you're not going to row again, and you'll never be a pianist. I think it's going to be funny.
Fuck, I've got to bug you with some of the shit doctors say, eh?
Yeah.
I had an old lady come in today being like, well, the doctor said if I don't get cataract surgery, I'm not going to be able to drive in 2 years. And I was like, well, they shouldn't have said that, because one, you can, and like, I was like, is there anything medical wrong with you? Because like, if that's grounds, then you can't drive. But your vision's fine. Like, yeah. You can't say that. Like, you're in your 80s. You've had cataracts for years. Like, fuck. Yeah. And that's the same sort of shit. Oh yeah.
Yeah. You can't. Yeah.
I'm not going to give you a chance right now, Daniel.
He said that. Obviously, it was gutting. later, I ended up buying a piano and self teaching. I was like, man, fuck that doctor. I'll show him. He's got no idea, but I did it for me.
What do you play, Michael?
Nothing very well, actually.
Sounds like me with a guitar sitting next to Betty Devon. I'm just like,
when no one's there, I feel like I play it well, but. Anyway, luckily it wasn't the case.
Yeah,
Could get back to rowing, but it was a relatively serious break. It was unlike your typical
break by name, break by nature.
Yeah, there was a bit of foreshadowing there.
Yeah,
unlike your typical 6 week recovery or 6 day a week for a broken bone, it was 3 months for that mm-hmm. one. So metal wear in there, holding the tip of the bone in the right place. And
have you still got it?
The metal wear?
Yeah.
They've still got it somewhere, yeah. I'm not sure where it is.
And not in you?
Not in me. No, not in me. It was because the wrist is quite thin. During winter, the metal would get quite cold and I got quite a sore wrist, so I got it out.
Yeah, old man said it was, Karapiri is one of those places where the cold just gets into your bones, and so it'd be even worse if you got a piece of metal in there.
Gets into the metal in your bones as well, yeah. Can't confirm
that. Oh, nice. So you went to the pier after that?
Yeah, well, so when I was in the hospital a couple of days after the break, my pier partner, Tom, and coach came in and they said, oh, we've talked to the docs and it's a bad break. We've got to deselect you from the pier.
Yeah.
Oh, man. And that was my shot. 3 days after. So
was it just going back? Was that a new season and they were like, Mike, you're going for the pier?
Yeah. I'd been officially selected for the pair with Tom.
Yeah.
Like it was, you're going to be competing at the World Champs.
And that was because of the Nationals, you'd done well in the pair? Or?
We had a good season. I think we were unbeaten at regattas that off season.
Yeah.
And then come trials, we...
Together, you'd rode together.
We rode together the off season, yeah. And we'd done quite well. So it was a promising off season.
Mm-hmm.
And then, the break happened and... 3 days after I broke my wrist, though, Tom, the guy I rode with, he broke three toes.
So neither of you went?
Well, so they said, oh, it's only broken toes. It should take 6 weeks to recover. We're not going to bring you guys back because Tom will still beat you back by 6 weeks. So Tom trained for 2 weeks, and I think I took about 10 days off and then started training as well.
Mm-hmm.
Just legs going back on the bike, and he got some x-rays done at 2 weeks, and the doctor said, I don't know how they do it, but they said it looks like you broke this yesterday, your bones haven't healed at all. And so he goes, oh shit. And so the coach goes, oh bloody hell. At this point he's pretty pissed off.
Got no rowers.
He said, well, now we're messing around. The other guy who's been recently, who's been brought into the pier to fill my spot. So he said, oh, you two cripples, you're reselected for the pier together and you'll train on the land for a couple of months and that's the plan this season. And so Tom couldn't use his feet. well, his foot. So he was on one of those assault bikes where you just peeling with the arms.
God's sake.
And he was doing a couple hours a day on that.
What?
Yeah, he was doing a couple to, geez, I can't remember. He might have even done a few hours. And he was doing a lot of weights as well, upper body weights.
Okay. Yeah, I've done 1,000 calories on a watt bike a couple of times, and it's not fun.
No.
At all.
No.
And that's with using the legs.
Yeah.
Because could he use his legs doing that, or not really?
Not really. Yeah, I mean, he could use one, but I think he just ended up just resting them and just doing arms.
Doing arms, fuck.
We'd set up on the deck at Rowing NZ, and at this point, the assault bike wasn't a commonly used piece of machinery.
Noisy, although it's how it
ergs. Noisy, but also for a rower who either ergs on the rowing machine or bikes,
yeah,
that movement looked real gumby. And I remember he was quite ashamed about it, or at least put on a bit of a show acting to be ashamed. Because people would look up and go, oh, what's he doing? You know, well, I knew what he was doing, but
Was the ski erg around there? Although I suppose there's a bit of pressure through your legs, but
yeah, it was. But yeah, he couldn't get on his toes.
Yeah,
because of the broken toes, he had to fully offload them. Especially after he found out that he wasn't healing. So we were just this rehab pair for a couple of months, and following the year before, where I worked out that you can actually get a benefit out of being out of the boat, I thought, well, shit, I'm going to push it a bit more this time. And so we did some stupid time on our machines. Our training would go in phases still, so you'd have a lighter week and you'd build, and you'd come back and you'd come back a little bit higher each block, so you were progressively building up. And during a heavy week, it was 6 hours on the bike a day wasn't uncommon for 6 days a week, and you had a day off, and it was just enough to get head above water and go again and do six more days. The longest ride I did was 6.5 hours continuous.
Did you distract yourself, or you were just bloody minded about the thing?
There's only so many movies you can watch on the bike, and then you just get bored and zone out.
We're like Joe Rogan and watching bloody Keanu Reeves kill a whole bunch of rumour people over and over again. John Wick, wasn't it? What he watched over and over again.
I don't think I think only the first John Wick was out at that point. So, and again, there's only so many times you can watch John Wick in one day before you got to move on.
Was Netflix starting to be a thing then?
I think it might have been.
Might have still been DVDs at that station.
Yeah, my CD player didn't last that long.
Yeah.
I thought I went through a few headphones.
I was going to say headphones were sweat.
Drown them in sweat, and yeah, 6.5 hours on the bike was the longest, and that was brutal.
Yeah,
you get through some food on that as well. Yeah.
Back to Eric and Hamish, like soaking the floor. Like, what does that even look like when there's 8 or 10 of you trying to bust out an hour erg? Like, is the place just damp rankness?
Yeah, it smells as well.
Yeah,
it smells of BO. It's like the only thing I could liken it to really would be a swamp. it's disgusting. Yeah, we were training in Switzerland. This was I think this was the Rio campaign. This was the 2016 year, and we were. If any of the guys end up listening to this, they will recall this session vividly as well. And we were training in this place called Sursee in Switzerland, and we had our rowing machine, our erg room, upstairs, and it was kind of like an attic of a rowing club. The airflow was poor. It was a heat wave at the time, a European heat wave, so it was stinking hot. And we had a brutal long session to do, and God, it was so hard. But when we got off the ergs and stood on the floor, I should say, there was a little bit of a sag in the floor, so it allowed it to pull quite nicely, and it ended up being nearly ankle deep.
Oh,
you got out and you're thinking, this is disgusting.
That's probably why it sags. It's just had that season after season after season.
But, I mean, we got some wild stories about how much we've sweat, because Japan was hot for the Tokyo Olympics. The 2017 world champs were hot, and so we would frequently do heat training in hot areas and measure our weight loss to work out how much we've sweated.
Yeah.
To work out how much we've got to replace it with.
Of like a race piece or a training piece?
Training.
Yeah.
So So we did, there was, I mean, another time, and this was probably the most impressive stat I've got for sweat. Impressive or gross, I don't know, you're about to find out and judge for yourself. We were training in Italy again during a heat wave. This was 2018, 2019. And so it was stinking hot. I think we were training in around 40 degrees. And we'd have to weigh ourselves before and after to just make sure we weren't losing too much to sweat.
Yeah.
You get halfway through a row and water's sloshing around in the boat and you go, we haven't gone through a wave. It's been dead flat water and my water bottle hasn't leaked. So the only thing that is sweat.
It's sweat.
That's sloshing around in the bottom. Not so bad for us, but for a coxswain who gets, who's sitting down and gets, comes out of the boat with wet balls, you're going, oh, that's someone's sweat.
Yeah.
That's not so nice. But I ended up losing 5.5 kgs over a 2-hour row.
Jesus.
And drank 2 liters of water, so sweated out 7.5 kgs.
Gnarly.
Yeah.
So what was the system for rehydrating? Just
drink as much
as
you can. Yeah. It was we had the proper way that we meant to do it, and it was I think it was a liter an hour.
Yeah.
You weren't meant to have more than a liter an hour, and you were meant to drink 1.5 times what you sweated out. Which I remember having some heated discussions with the nutritionists about how I was meant to get that in, and only heated. They were very reasonable. It was heated from me because I was severely dehydrated and angry about the situation.
Straight. And then how did you sleep? Or you didn't wake up in the night and you go to the piss? You were that dehydrated?
No, you didn't pee.
Yeah.
When we were sweating that much.
Did you get any like dangerous levels, like going to the toilet and the old Coke pee sort of level?
Didn't get to that, but got so getting quite paranoid and getting those some of the mental effects of dehydration.
Did anybody ever overhydrate?
Not with any negative side effects.
Yeah.
But when there was times where you're going to the loo every 5 minutes because you've drunk so much water.
Yeah.
But we never had any serious effects from overhydration.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's good, I suppose.
Yeah. What happens with that?
You can die.
from overhydration.
Overhydrating.
It's like drowning or something.
Yeah, sort of. It's a problem in marathons where they have too many drink stops. And I don't think it's too bad with the elite level stuff. But like the people that do in sort of 4 hours and stuff, they stop at each drink station and they have a big drink of water. They can dilute their electrolytes and can kill them.
Holy heck.
Yeah, I think it gives you a heart attack.
Sure, I didn't realise that was a thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to put this glass of water
down. Nah. like I say, it'd be over a good period of time and you've just overcooked it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've had Tim Nicks on the podcast and that was one of the big things he sort of found in the 90s, I think it was, that that's one of his big claims before he was sort of demonised for low-carb stuff.
Right.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting... He's found a lot of interesting things about nutrition and sport, but now he's obviously hotly debated.
Yeah, it doesn't take much these days.
Yeah. On the flip side of all the gnarly stuff, did you sort of have some fun moments? Eric on Between Two Bears was talking about a pub in Lucerne that I think they picked up
the
a swan.
The one where Eric got the swan, yeah. What was that? That was Pickwick's in Lucerne that we used to go to. They still go there.
Yeah.
We had plenty of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had plenty of fun. There was one time in Lucerne as well that we were young. We were, was it the Rio campaign? No, I think it was the year before Rio. It was 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And we had an average age in our crew of, I think, 21. it was a young crew. And we got to 9 p.m. on a Saturday night. So we'd have Sundays off. And we got to 9 p.m. and we thought, oh, we're bored, what should we do? And the logical thing would be go to sleep.
Bed, yeah.
you're paid athletes on tour and you've got a rest day for a reason. But, I was 20 at the time. Oh, we're bored, what should we do? Oh, we'll catch a train into Lucerne, which was 15 minutes away. So we went in and we didn't go crazy. We had a couple
All good stories out of the All Blacks start with we caught a train.
Caught a train, yeah. And we had a couple beers and there was an art festival on and we ended up smooth talking our way into this art festival because we did. And then we got to I can't remember what time it was, but it wasn't super late. We thought, oh shoot, we better head back. The last train had gone.
Fuck.
And we're like, oh shit. So we
hide box.
So well, what do you? What do we do? Like, oh, we better go to that nightclub over there and work out what our plan is. So we ended up going to this nightclub, and we were still miles out from Pinnacle event. Like, I'm talking 6-7 weeks out. And we ended up having a bloody good night. We didn't catch any swans.
Bring them in the club.
Yeah, we had a good time. As you know, young guys travelling, and we ended up all sleeping in the train station at about, yeah. I got a photo somewhere. But we were kind of like sleep. We're all sleeping on one park bench, kind of piled on each other, waiting for the 5 a.m. train to start up. we almost got away with it. Except when we were coming back up from the train station to our accommodation, the team manager was heading out at 6 to return a rental van on Sunday morning and busted us. So we got a lot of crap for that.
Yeah.
And we were given some particularly hard sessions because of what we'd done.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And I think that was actually what led to the sweaty erg room story.
So, like, you go to Plovdiv, you know, yeah, what? Still at high school?
Yeah, it was last year at high school, 2012, yeah.
And you win?
Yeah.
Do you think you learned anything out of that? And then how does that compare to getting to go to your first Olympics, Rio de Janeiro? The water's a bit questionable. But and you guys, as you say, finished last in the A final. But
learn anything from juniors? You learn everything. You learn a lot from anything, right? If you reflect on it, I guess, but juniors was just, well, it was my first time stepping up from school level to New Zealand rep. They push you hard, but it's not ridiculous. You know, you're still kids and they're aware of that. But it was my first time going to Europe.
Yeah.
So kind of, you know, mind blowing seeing all the history over there compared to home. You know, we're a few hundred years old, our country, whereas they're 1500 years old.
They've rebuilt after a couple of wars too.
Yeah, so totally mind-blowing going over there. Learned quite a lot about bringing together a team that has been selected because of individual ability. Obviously there's an element of how well we gelled together that came into selection, but
what were your events at high school?
I did the 4 and the 8 for the sweeping events, and our stroke seat, Tom Jenkins, he did the pair, and he was a legend of our year group at school. He was just an absolute weapon in that boat. So he was in the pair, and then we had Tom Murray, who I was talking about earlier, who did the pair with. He won the 4, so they beat us in the 4. He did the 8 as well. Can't remember where they finished. And then the other guy with the coxswain was Sam Bosworth. So he ended up, you know, we had quite different rowing careers. Sam coxed the women's 8 for quite a while, and then ended up back in the same boat with Tom Murray for the Tokyo Olympics. And then the last guy was Cam Webster. Yeah. Who was one of my best mates from school, so we actually rode through Westlake together. We were sitting next to each other, and
you did quite a lot together with North Shore too, eh?
We did heaps together. Yeah, we've done heaps. We've been lucky enough to win heaps of national titles together, and we've shared a lot of our rowing journey together, and we've only recently kind of split paths. He's gone on to Emirates Team New Zealand as a cyclo, which is awesome. We've shared a lot together. It's been really cool. But coming back to the juniors though, bringing together all of those different backgrounds. That was my first time doing that, because for the school rowing, it was like we're all from the same school, so we all want to row, so we row together. Whereas this time round, it was people kind of hand picked, and how do we bring this together? And for school rowing, we had 4 years until our final Pinnacle event, whereas for juniors we had about 6 weeks, I think, of training back after trials, training on our own, And then we had an 8-week training block, and then we went to the World Champs. So it wasn't massive.
Yeah.
But it was intense.
How did you sort of figure out how to push each other? Was that all part of it? Like, how hard we can all work?
I think at that age it was we had a lot of guidance from our coaches. Yeah. Still, there was still a lot of hand holding.
Yeah.
And very, very firm guidance, which at that age I think it was necessary.
Yeah.
In part because I won't speak for the others, but I definitely didn't know what the standard was or where it could be or where I could take myself.
And was that also the first time you were introduced to like world standard times and like prognostic?
Absolutely, yeah.
Rowing.
yeah. First time to progs. And
can you explain prognostics to people that might not understand what you guys do out on the course?
Yeah, so prognostics, we every boat class in rowing goes at a different speed.
Hmm.
I'll use for this example a women's single and a men's eight, which are typically at relatively opposite ends of the speed spectrum. You can still compare a woman's single performance against a men's eight performance, obviously just not by speed.
Hmm.
But what you can take is you can take the percentage of the world record speed. So say a men's eight, for example, these numbers aren't accurate, but say a men's eight, to get a world record, the speed is 10 meters per second average.
Hmm.
Across a 2K piece. Say you go out and do a piece, it can be any length, and you average 9 meters per second. Well, then if your world's best was 10, then you got a 90% prognostic.
Mm.
And so with that way, so a woman's single, it's again, it might be for the, you know, the point of explaining this, that might be 5 meters per second for a world record. It's probably a lot faster than that. And Emma, for example, might go out and do 4.9, in which case she's got like a 98% prognostic.
Mm.
And so you can compare that percentage to see how you did.
Mm.
Because going off times is not always that accurate because you've got varying conditions. You might have current, you might have wind, you might have a longer distance as opposed to, you might do a 10K piece.
Mm.
And so you can't just go off time. So what you can do is you can use your prognostics to benchmark against other crews. And that came into play. Well, we used that throughout the whole New Zealand rowing journey, but we used it a lot. We leaned into it a lot for the Tokyo campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Because we had 4 gold medal crews. So we had a lot of consistent high achievers around us.
Mm.
That we could chase down. And we didn't have any international competition, so we needed to find something to chase. And
mm.
and we had some of the best in the world rowing alongside us, but because we were the men's eight, which is on, you know, by speed, it's one of the faster boats. We needed to use those percentages, and we did. Without it, I don't think we would have done anywhere near as well as we did.
How did that differ from Rio?
Rio, we were a bit green in Rio. We didn't have the same level of maturity that we had in Tokyo.
Yeah.
None of us had, bar our coach, had been to the Olympics, so it was also the Olympics is something else. It's like going to the circus. You've got media in your face everywhere. You've got at least for rowing, where there's typically world champs, is not very fancy. There's so much going on around you. There's Usain Bolt's walking into the food hall. You've got Nadal walking around. You've got all of these
basketballers, NBA basketballers.
Yeah, all the basketballers. There's 20,000 of the world's a good chunk of the world's best athletes.
Mm.
For Rio, there's free McDonald's, which you're not taking, you're not having until after your racing. But you get a free phone, you get all of this. There's just so much distraction as well. I'm getting at.
Mm.
And no matter how much you get told about it, I think for your first Olympics, you'll always get caught off guard by how intense that is. And we got caught off a bit by that, but our lead in was also not very good. We didn't have a very good lead in. We our wheels fell off a wee bit. I think we stopped having fun.
Mm-hmm.
That year before, you know, like I said, we went into Lucerne and got a little bit silly. But in hindsight, probably at the right time, you know, it was in the middle of a hard training block. It probably wasn't the best thing for physical performance, but for actual crew bonding and not being too serious, it was probably actually just right for a bunch of 21 year olds. But then for the Olympic year, because it was the Olympics, we said, we're not doing any of that this year.
Yeah.
And we didn't. And I think we were just a bit too tense.
Stiffed yourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. You were obviously in the pier, but what was it like, the guys saying about Mahi and Bondi coming into the eight? Like, and then Tony O'Connor, Doco, kind of talked about it, like being the saviour. And then Sean, we'd mentioned him before, his speech, he kind of talks about being stuck in the middle between...
Sean was literally in between Hamish and Mahi, yeah.
Having a fight about, like, Bondi calling Mahi fat and Mahi saying you don't know how to move a boat. They never lost a race in the pier. Don't know how to move a boat. And he's a rower, and Mahi's a scholar.
It was cool. It was cool having those guys commit to the eight. Don't get me wrong, that I don't reckon that the eight in Tokyo, I don't know if it would have happened if they had.
That would have been like the genesis of taking it forward, right?
I think it definitely contributed.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, Bondi was the spark for the Tokyo eight that breathed that life back into it, in my opinion. But Mahi and Hamish coming back was awesome to see.
Yeah.
I don't think it quite had the desired effect and didn't quite go how everyone expected. I don't know why. I wasn't close enough to them.
Yeah.
To know why that is. I mean, at least for the history books, it's cool seeing Mahi and Hamish in an eight together. That's pretty sweet.
Yeah.
The closest I got to those guys during that was Sean, Mahi, Stephen Jones, Brooke Robertson, and I. Those guys were all in the eight while I was in the pier. We shared an Airbnb for 6 weeks.
Nice.
while we were on a training camp. So I kind of heard how things were going for those guys, but I was pretty focused on the pier and not dehydrating at that point.
It
was one of those heat waves.
So here's a rumour. Michael, you can say as much or as little as you want about this one. Because you qualified the pier.
Yeah.
Did Bondi threaten to seat race you out if you didn't join the eight?
He did.
He did do that.
Yeah. No, I think it was good taste blackmail. I heard a rumour that he was bluffing. In the moment, I didn't want to take that risk though.
Yeah.
He did say that. He, because Bondi had gone off and he was doing his Commonwealth Games cycling and obviously doing bloody well at that, but with his cycling, he'd lost a lot of his upper body strength.
Yeah.
And then he came back and he was as fit as anything, but it took him a while to build back the arms that he needed for rowing. And so the first year that he was building back, Tom and I managed to hold off any attempts that he had to beat us and race him. Still an absolute weapon in training. Like, he was still beating us a little bit in training in that season. But when it came to racing, we'd get him, and we got him and we held our spot. But then COVID came around and we didn't race. And he had another year and a half to get ready. Yeah. And he did. And then that season during the pandemic, he would consistently beat me by about 4 seconds in a pair, to the point where it knocked my confidence enough that I thought, shit, I probably fancy myself in second place behind him for stroke side.
Mm-hmm.
And then he did come to me and said, if you go for the pair, I'll go for the pair. But if you go for the eight, I'll go for the eight. And I was like, oh, fuck. I remember saying, man, can you just fuck off?
So how did it go, was Tony there yet?
Tony was there, yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. I
or like the selectors start talking to you, like, Michael, what are you going to do this season? Like, we know you've qualified the boat.
It came to me quite early.
Bondi did.
He came to me quite early. It was quite a bit before trials. And he said, "Oh, you know, have a bit of a think about it." I remember we went out for dinner one night, and he said that, like, bastard. But I had a hunch he might be bluffing, but it wasn't. You know, at that point I was pretty confident. I was a bit burnt out from it all with the pandemic and Ugin, and I was sick of injuries and cross training, and I remember I called heaps of people for advice on it, because I spoke to Mike Stanley about it.
Mm-hmm.
He stroked the 82-83-8, and he's been a mentor my whole rowing career.
Pretty sure I had Mike stay at my house a couple of times. Back in the day when I was little.
Small country. Hey?
Yeah. We had Rob Waddell stay at our house too. Oh. It was random.
Did he eat all your food?
Oh, fuck. Just a little tangent. I was in Taumuru and Sonia and their daughter came in, and I retold the story to Sonia. I was like, I remember sitting there just watching him eat these massive, like, bowls of muesli. He'd like pour one, finish it, pour another, finish it. Then we went out and trained, then he came back, did the same thing again. I was just like, this is unreal. It's just like, yeah, sounds about right.
Rob, in his athlete days, I mean, even now he's talking about, he was a big, impressive.
Oh yeah, the ducking into the door thing was pretty unreal. I'm 8, and I was like, Jesus.
Yeah. He's one of those guys, him and Paddy, and they're two guys every time. And George Bridgewater, George.
Yeah.
Those three guys, every time I see them, I've seen them countless times, every time I see them again, I'm like, Jesus, you are tall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you at New Zealand Rowing when James Dallinger pulled himself off the erg, broke the handle?
Nah.
Yeah, there must have been. Oh, no, because I was in the four.
I wasn't around when he did that.
Yeah, I did confirm it with Dallinger. I'd heard that he went through the wall and carried on, but no, he said, I flew off the erg, broke the handle.
Dallinger did that?
Yeah.
Oh, jeez. Well, he's got that farm strength, hasn't he?
Yeah, farm. Yeah.
Jeez, where were we?
We're talking about body threatening to take out. And then how he actually ended up trialing in the eight.
Right, yeah. So I spoke to Mike, and he gave me some good advice, and then I spoke to Barry Mabbitt as well. He was he'd been a coach at North Shore and Westlake, and I asked him for some advice on that, and he agreed with Mike, and talked to a few others, and asked the audience, came back with a pretty unanimous go for the eight.
Mm-hmm.
And
then to not qualify, what did that feel like?
Well, yeah, because, I mean, context, right, we'd qualified the pair, and the eight wasn't qualified.
Yeah.
The eight missed out narrowly, and it sounds worse than it was. The eight just missed out on qualifying.
It was another one of those beep-beep moments.
Exactly. They just missed out on qualifying, but on top of that, they're only 4 seconds off first anyway.
Mm.
So from first to sixth where they got to not qualify, they were still only 4 seconds off first place. So the eight, it wasn't.
Did you not run that race?
No, I was in the pier.
Oh, that was the same as the pier,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, so that was the year that we got second in the pier and qualified that. The boys, still went bloody fast. That was with Hamish and Mahe, that one, but missed out by, 0.1 or 0.2 of a second or something on qualifying the eight.
Yeah.
And so fast forward it a year, through the pandemic, I didn't fancy taking on Hamish and didn't fancy seeing whether he was bluffing, and on top of that, the eight was going quite well at that point. We'd done a bit of training in it, and it was going pretty handy, and also Tom and I weren't making the pair click as well as we had in the past for a reason that at that point we couldn't work out. It was frustrating us. So the eight seemed like a good option, all things considered.
Yeah.
Said I put it out there that I wasn't going to be going for the pier. Bondi also said the same at that point, which might have been the plan. I would have felt like a real dick if he then said he was going for the pier after I said I was going for the eight. which then I think in turn, Tom also decided that he'd go for the eight. So at that point, and the other guys that were in the eight previously were all keen on that as well, and so at that point it was again, you know, relatively unanimous that we'd try and, for the first time since I don't know when, maybe back in the 80s, we were prioritizing the eight,
yeah,
for men's sweep, because it had been the pair for so long,
yeah,
and probably the four about 15 years ago, but yeah, we're prioritizing the eight again. So yeah, there we were.
And then they send you on a mission with no guarantees of coming home.
yeah. Well, so you're right. Yeah, so the eight wasn't qualified. So in the middle of the pandemic, we had to go to Switzerland to qualify.
So you were like one of the first people to leave the country and some of the first people to come back in, right?
Yeah, we were.
Some of the first people to get vaccinated.
We did jump the queue. Yeah, we got, this is a bit controversial, I guess, but we kept it very quiet at the time. We got vaccinated at the same time as the people that were, you know, at risk. People with like...
Had doctors started?
I think we were around the start, yeah, of the doctors.
I sort of got one around February-ish, maybe March.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then...
When did we get ours?
My first one, because I was in Hawke's Bay, it was pretty much like all doctors in the later end of the doctors were starting to get it. And then my second one, all the, being Hawke's Bay, all the people that were fruit picking and elderly had started to get it.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
So
you were before all them. Yeah.
I remember we were jumping the queue quite badly, and someone was saying, don't tell anyone because it looks quite bad, but you've just been given special treatment to get over and qualify your boat.
Yeah.
So I mean, we were very lucky in that regard. Very lucky that we were given that, because I mean, without that, we probably couldn't have gone. So,
yeah.
Anyway, we got sat down. We were sat down, I think it was a few weeks out from needing to depart. And Rowing New Zealand, they weren't going to send anyone to this regatta.
Mm.
And this was even before the pandemic. They decided, they'd said, if you don't qualify the boat at the champs, we're not going to send anyone to Last Chance.
Mm-hmm.
And the logic behind it was sound. It was that if you can't qualify a boat in the first round, you're probably not in medal contention and we're going for medals, so why'd we take a crew...
Medals create funding too, right?
Correct, yep. Yeah. So why'd we take a crew that struggles to qualify when we're trying to get medals?
Does New Zealand Rowing have to pay for the Olympics, or is that Olympics pays for... Or New Zealand Olympics pays for...
I'm not sure about the Olympics. As far as the athlete funding goes, I believe that once you reach a certain point, or at least I think it may have changed recently, there's quite a bit going on at the moment,
yeah,
in that space, but when I was there, it was if you pass a certain performance standard at a pinnacle event, then the following year you were high performance sport funded. But below that, it was New Zealand Rowing funded, which typically came from sponsors, I believe, and their funding that they get from high performance sport.
We're trying to go
to Switzerland. They sat us down in a room and said, they weren't going to send a crew to that regatta, and then one of the sponsors, Sean Colgan, stepped up and I think he, Simon Peterson was the CEO at the time, and Sean gave Simon a check, a blank check, or a 100K check or something. So it was just something that was easily going to cover the campaign, and Simon was going to try and convince the board to send the eight, and Sean gave him that. So he said, if, you know, one of the first questions the board will ask is, where's the money going to come from? And he said, if they ask that question, here's your answer.
Yeah.
So we owe a lot to Sean, and BB, his wife, and Colgan Foundation for backing us on that.
Far out.
It's quite a power play, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it worked, and we got over. We ended up in this meeting that we were just talking about, and they said, oh, yeah, everyone here has a chance to say, I'm not comfortable with going over.
Yeah.
Because at that point, the pandemic was raging overseas, and I think New Zealand was COVID-free.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of unknowns and a lot of fear at that point. And so it was, you know, if you don't want to go, say. And there was a couple of tour managers that had family and stuff that opted against, which was totally fair. But all of the athletes said that they would go if they, you know, if they were in the crew or reserves, which was amazing because part of that trip was A, it was getting over there, but B, it was if Rowing NZ said to us, well, if you get COVID, we actually don't know how we're going to get you back. so they're like, well,
support. Was at that stage, like, basically if you tested positive, you couldn't get on a plane, eh?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep, and I don't know where they'd put you as well. And yeah, it was, we'll support you however best we can.
We'll figure it out.
It'll be, if you get COVID, we're just going to have to figure it out. And so they're like, holy heck, yeah. But everyone signed up for it, and fortunately no one got COVID. Because that would have completely derailed the whole campaign. So we got through, we qualified, and we qualified quite well against a crew that had previously raced. I think the Europeans were still racing through the pandemic.
Right.
The crew that we beat to qualify had been quite close to the Germans who were leading the field. And so we thought, geez, we're actually quite close.
Yeah.
But that was the only racing we got for the Olympics.
Yeah.
So then, yeah, we did that, and then we jumped on a plane and came back and spent two weeks in MIQ and pissed everyone off because of how much we were demanding. This sports team that's just had priority vaccinations now demanding from MIQ.
What was feeding like? Did you
the food was great.
Did they like smuggle you in supplements and stuff, or
we carried a bit with us.
Yeah.
So we took a bit overseas and brought a bit back with us. We had, so that was, you could receive deliveries. They weren't, the only thing they restricted was how much alcohol you bought in the room.
Yeah.
But for us, obviously, that didn't matter at that point.
Yeah.
Did
you go and allocate yours to someone else?
It all went to Tony.
Yeah, it wasn't cups of tea he was drinking. He was drinking all the booze.
we didn't have the booze.
Yeah.
We didn't need the booze. But we had quite a bit of support. We had quite a few generous people down in Christchurch. Marcel, I can't remember his last name, but he owned one of the pack and saves down there.
Nice.
He was quite generous, and there was someone else. We had some very generous support while we were in there, and people sending in supplements and care packages as well. So it wasn't just practical; it was, you know, support and making us feel good about what we're doing. And we had extra portions from MIQ as well. So yeah, we were quite well looked after. The only thing that would have been nicer would have been we were expecting to have two pieces of training equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Because doing one movement, and particularly the rowing movement, is quite brutal to achieve the volume that we want to.
Mm-hmm.
And actually complementing the rowing movement with some bike work is quite beneficial, especially if you're stuck on the ramp.
As you've proven twice.
As it worked out, yeah. So we were expecting to have a bike and an erg, but there was just a blanket rule, which it does make sense to have that blanket rule. The blanket rule was one piece of machinery per room for fire hazard.
Yeah.
So that you're not filling up the room with stuff.
And the sweat had probably set off the fire alarms.
Yeah, well, we had balconies, which was lucky.
Nice.
Yeah, so... so
what did you just do in terms of recovery? Did you have, like, normal boots or...?
No, we didn't, unfortunately.
Just turn the shower on cold.
Sit in the bath, yeah.
Sit in the bath.
Put some bath salts in.
Yeah.
Light a candle.
Yeah, you got nothing else to do. Yeah.
Oh, we were allowed out to walk.
Yeah.
When you're stuck in a hotel room, we were training a lot. We're doing about 2.5 hours a day on average on the rowing machine.
Fuck.
Yeah, it sucked. But I mean, with all the downtime, we had people studying, but you just stretch and you know, I think some guys might have taken golf clubs in and practiced their swing. And but it was a combination of luck and the fact that we had some pretty strong protocols in place to stay injury free because of how unsupported we were compared to being in the normal high performance environment. and that isolation, and his isolation with no physio, no massage, no docs, no you know, no variety of training, just one, one injury would stop your training, and then what are you going to do? You can't do anything.
So then how does that contrast, what, 6 weeks later to being in Tokyo? Like Sean talks about, like, again, and you too, it says well for Rio, like, distraction. Like, what, like, completely different. Was the whole village isolated there?
It was meant to be.
Sort of.
It was meant to be. But at the same time, they had to feed 10,000 athletes at once, so...
It was leaky.
There was gaps.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't know how they would have got around it. They couldn't have delivered that many meals, you know, and got...
Did they test people while they're there?
Yeah, it was daily testing. Daily PCR testing for everyone.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. It was a saliva testing. So it was pretty accurate.
It was spinning all the time.
It was spinning all the time, which was hard when you're dehydrated in Japan in summer. The distractions were... I mean, we had... Hamish, it was his fourth Olympics.
Yeah.
For Tom, Sean, and I, it was our... I hope I'm not missing anyone. I think for Tom, Sean, and I, it was our...
He's in the front four there first.
Okay.
The front four is... They didn't end up being the front four, didn't they?
Yeah.
Matt, Tom, Phil, Dan.
Yeah, yeah. So we four of the rowers plus Sam was their first Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
And we, because we kind of, I think we were quite focused. We were a bit more mature than our Rio crew was at the time of Rio.
Mm-hmm.
But we were a bit more focused. But I mean, we also we decided, it is also the Olympics. Mm. So we decided the first day you are allowed to soak it in as much as you want. You can rub a neck and you can have a look around. You can, when we go up for a row, you can look out of the boat, which is a bit of a no-no in rowing. You can have a look and you know, walk around the village as well a wee bit.
So we're here.
And actually experience it.
Yeah.
But as soon as we're into the second day, if you get caught, you're in shit. So it's you know, we're fully focused again from day two, and it, I think that actually worked quite well.
And so you just had to do four races at that regatta, eh?
We did three.
Heat, rep,
and final.
And final, right.
Yeah. And yeah, we fucked up the heat, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah. we didn't have a very good race. We just got excited. Overexcited.
Was any part of the race good or not?
It was all good. We weren't far off the pace.
Yeah.
But we just weren't where we knew we could be.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't row the way that we, you know, had rowed for the last 8 weeks leading, you know, between MIQ and the Olympics, and that was disappointing that we hadn't executed, but it was also exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of not what you'd expect coming off the water from having, you know, not qualifying for the final again, so we were back in an unqualified position. And we'd thought that we were in a better position than that, but you'd think we would be quite down about it, but it was actually, we came off and everyone was actually quite excited, because I think we'd all realised that we were quite far off executing what we knew we could.
Yeah, well, you'd done one race in 2 years.
We'd done the qualification race, and then we'd come in and done this heat.
Yeah.
And also we'd gone up against everyone that we're going to be racing for an Olympic medal, so it was like, you know, the excitement was, we just got overexcited.
Yeah.
And everyone knew that we hadn't done what we knew we should have done. You know, it'd be like, I don't know the equivalent, like, you know, it'd be like if you were a race car driver and you had to drive a certain line, and you just got excited and tried overtaking, and when you should have driven during a, you know what I mean? It was just the process that we knew we had to follow in our heads. It was so clear, but we had gotten excited and not done that.
Yeah.
And so we knew we hadn't done what we knew we had to do and what we knew we could do. So because it was so, I don't, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because it was so clear cut,
mm-hmm,
that we hadn't done what...
I was like, oh, well, we're just going to go and do what we need to do.
Exactly. It was just, we just have to go and do what we know we have to do.
Yeah, I've had a few rugby games like that. One in particular comes to mind, playing against Lincoln down in Christchurch. they creamed us, and then they played them in the final. I was like, well, I know what I had to do.
And you creamed them.
Yeah. And, well, and you got, yeah, we beat them.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, no, it's interesting like that.
Well, it's the crazy thing about, you know, sport is you can get caught up in the moment and
yeah,
and the whole race or the whole game can go by and you just can't flip the switch. But
yeah,
you go off, you have a breath, and you come back and play again, and you can correct it.
Yeah, no, it's interesting, eh?
Mm.
So I was in the roast hut in Te Awamutu with my phone leaning up against the window, banging on the steel benches. Then I drove up, I was messaging Dad and my brothers, being like, this is shit hot. Drove up to Auckland, then went to the Cloud. I was picking up Paddy.
To get up to the Cloud, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And so he'd been at the Cloud. I was talking to Kevin, I can't think of his last name.
Burgess.
Yeah, Kevin Burgess, yeah. And then Paddy walks past me, and he's kind of like, oh, Ryan, how you going?
At the Cloud.
At the Cloud. Do you reckon you could take me home? Or like, mate, that's why I'm here. Isn't that Tony O'Connor documentary? Is that the Cloud that video footage is from, or is that from inside?
That's the Cloud,
yeah. Yeah, because I think I can see Kim Burgess' arm up video again as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, because within that hour, right, Emma won.
Yeah.
The woman's eight got a very close silver.
Yeah.
And then we won.
Yeah.
But Emma was kind of expected because she'd just been so dominant for the whole season.
Yeah.
The whole Olympic cycle, really. And then, and throughout the regatta, she just, every race, she's just lengths in front. And the women's eight did well, but I think because they'd won in 2019, you know, there was definitely a hope that they'd be able to pull off a win.
Yeah, I just missed that race. I was real gutted. Yeah.
So their race, I think the reaction was a bit of a, ooh, but then no one expected us to win.
It was awesome.
I don't even know how many of us expect, none of us, I don't think any of us expected to win.
Every time I watch that 1,000 metres, I'm just like, what the fuck is going on there?
Yeah.
And then I think the commentators, because they're Poms, call it, oh, Britain's doing a move. And they're like doing a move, like moving up on Germany, and you guys are moving further ahead. It's just like, they're going real fast, and you guys are going even faster.
So even the commentators watching the race didn't expect it.
They're like, here comes Great Britain, and you guys are moving out further. Like, well, what about that one?
it was very cool being there. I wouldn't change that, but the Cloud was a very close second on that day. It looked like a lot of fun.
Yeah, they were still I probably got there about 8 o'clock or something, and they were still pretty euphoric, and I think they were starting to break up the champagne in the middle of the day. Was starting to take an effect.
it was 1 o'clock in New Zealand that we raised, wasn't
yeah.
it? Was,
yeah.
Jeepers. I heard that a 10 grand bar tab went down quite quickly. It was put up as once we crossed the line, and I heard it was gone quite quick.
Yeah, yeah, got spent on champagne.
Yeah, very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, no. So then, like you said, that it's a chance to enjoy the village?
Not even that. Well, we start. So, again, because of COVID, everyone got shipped out quite quickly.
Oh, real?
So there was quite a big group. I think it was quite a decent chunk of the New Zealand team that competed in the first week. So it was as rowers, there was triathletes, surfers were with us as well, swimming, rugby, sevens, men and women, and also quite good results in that group, obviously. And so we all got sent back the day after the rugby, so 2 days after rowing.
Yeah.
And that was where
did you get to go watch?
No, we watched from home. Well, watched from the village.
Yeah.
There was no spectators, eh?
Fuck.
Yeah.
Yeah, obviously.
Empty stands at rowing, empty stadium for rugby.
With Michaela, obviously, you'd be quite close to her, but I still can't, like, watch them do the haka after them winning. It, like, brings me tears. Like, their story's similar to the eight. Like, Rio being so close and, like, following it along and, you know, I played rugby sevens, and so, you know, followed it for 8 years, and then to see what they did, which is like awesome. And like, I remember Ruby, we came up here in 2014, and her like grabbing the mic and commentating a women's final game at Mount Sevens.
Yeah.
And then so, yeah, just to like know her a little bit as a character, and then follow the journey, and it's just like, oh, yeah.
Oh, that team's amazing, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
what they've done and how they've done it is
And then it's the same like 2 years later with the 15s as well. You're just like, fire out, this is awesome.
Yeah, they're on fire, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's gonna be pretty cool getting to watch this time.
Yeah, well, you know, I've retired and Kayla's still going, so
yeah,
I get to experience life on the other side now. So far it's been great.
Yeah.
So far it's been brilliant. Yeah, I've watched a couple of I've been over and watched her a couple of times live now, and it's good fun. It's
party atmosphere.
Obviously different to being an athlete, but
you haven't.
I'm quite happy with it.
Haven't poked your head in the outer grounds and thought, oh, I could do a bit of that, and you know,
nah. I'm quite happy in the stands with my beer in hand.
Yeah. At the moment. Well, they've got their beer in hand after they've finished playing.
That's true.
Yeah. So, Michael, there's not to pick on Erica Mahi, but there's a couple of body shapes post rowing. Erica Mahi. And then there's Hamish and Nathan Cohen and Joseph Sullivan type vibes.
Yeah. I've spent quite a bit of time with Joe, actually.
I think Joe and Nathan did five passes with Richie McCaw.
Yes, yep. Joe's told me all about that. He told me about him being the only person who had the power on his legs to draft off a truck and getting he got absolutely abused for doing that on five passes, drafting off a truck. So.
Was that from sailing or...?
Doing the five passes or
no, him being that strong in the legs.
Dude's just got another gear, eh?
Yeah.
Like you know, the normal person's got 5 years. A high performance athlete tends to have six, and Joe's just got seven or eight. Like it's unreal.
What's interesting about Joe is he's always had that. I remember Andrew telling me about, and they used to call him Wingnut because of his ears. Right. Like at Marty, he's just crazy shit. Like. Finish one race, run it down to the start, and win one race.
Yeah.
Then right back down to the start, and then and win the next one.
It's unreal.
Like change boats on the side of the lake.
It's just so, but it's so strong. He can just push himself. But we spend a bit of time lately doing some coastal rowing together, and we even went over to the World Champs last year again. Colgan Foundation supported, which was brilliant. And Joe and I've been 2 years retired at that point, and Joe a couple of years out of sailing, I think, as well. And Jesus, he's still got it. It's been 10 years, 10 years since he was rowing, and he's still just jumps in a boat and 1 month training camp, and I think he got a fourth to eighth finish on the coastal at the World Champs.
Yeah.
I don't know how he does it, to be honest, but he's bloody good fun to row it.
Yeah, unfortunately, as I said, the Paddy McInnes episode got lost to the ether. We talked about coastal rowing, and he clarified it's not togs up the bum. You've got to slide.
No, there's no Vaseline at coastal rowing. it's very similar to a rowing setup.
Yeah,
you got to slide, down to the measurements and the biomechanics of coastal. It's almost the same as flatwater rowing.
Yeah.
But it's in the ocean.
And there's a running component.
I'm trying to get Michaela into it, but she won't do it. Yeah. It's just the deal she's got must be too good.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
And they're all coxed or no?
It's coming into the Olympics for LA.
Mm-hmm.
There is a coxed event, but not for the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
So similar to rowing, how there's a bunch of events that are non-Olympic events. The coxed mixed quad is non-Olympic. And then the three Olympic events are men's solo, they're not calling them singles, men's solo, women's solo, and mixed double.
Mm-hmm.
First mixed Olympic event for rowing.
Yeah. Yeah, that'd be interesting.
Which we're actually doing quite well at that at the moment.
Yeah.
Our lightweights, Matt Dunham and Jackie Kittle, won that at World Champs last year. So.
One last question there, Michael. The New Zealand folklore that is the Boss Rooster.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got to paint it blue, eh?
I painted it blue twice while it was the traditional coxed four.
Yeah.
And I think three times when it was the straight four, I transitioned and then we were there from coxed to...
But you guys were already holding it and you put another coat on, did you?
Yeah, we just put a thicker coat of paint.
Yeah.
I'd love to see a cross section of that thing one day.
Yeah, I reckon. Yeah, so I similar, not the same night after the 8, but the next time I was staying up at Jensen's, I woke up like I was sitting up in the landing, and sure enough, I was sleeping right next to the blue and white boss rooster.
Big blue rooster in your face.
Yeah. So, can you explain the rules of why you need to paint it?
Sure. So, yeah, it's a good event for the tradition around it. So, yeah, traditionally Cox forward, now straight ball.
Yeah.
The winner of that race is awarded the trophy, and within 1 hour of completing the race, so you better hope your podium's not delayed, within 1 hour of completing that race, the rooster needs to be painted in your club colours. And so usually if you expect that you might be in the running to win that, you'll have a spray can with your club's colours or multiple colours at the ready.
Yeah.
Because if you do not have it painted within 1 hour of it being of your race, you must shout a keg to the rest of the field on finals night, and it's usually on the it's on the last day that race. So, so you don't want to be late to paint that. But the other thing that occurs with that event is usually people will try and steal it.
Yeah.
So you spoke about the Irish guys at the start. They raced us in that 4-1 year that we won it, and they tried stealing it off us and ended up being a thrown in the lake WWE style with the Irish guys to stop them stealing our blue rooster.
Yeah.
So I mean that's the rules around it. There's some small other technical stuff as well. So you have to race in the Crespi, all one club.
Yeah.
Unlike other prem events. So
nice.
Yeah. And so we're actually going for that again this year.
You as well.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in that one.
Nice.
Yeah, I had a chat with Matt McDonald and some of the other guys
mm-hmm.
last week.
Wicked.
Yeah. I'm doing a little bit of training. I should be doing.
Is that why there was?
I did a half an hour before you showed up. So
good stuff.
The numbers are comparable too.
And that's always on the track.
To under 17 me. No, it's mine and Joe's Coastal Wars.
Oh right. Yeah.
Yeah. Gary Reid from Concept 2's been very generous in supporting that. So
nice.
Yeah, I also like it a lot.
Yeah, it does look good. Yeah.
People ask questions, I can talk about myself.
Yeah, I actually have got an Olympic gold. Do you want to see it? It's in the glove box.
I don't get any special treatment at home because she's got one as well.
Yeah. Awesome. So hopefully this has given people a bit of an insight, one, into rowing, but two, into what was an epic journey of the 8.
Yes.
Yeah, I'll also put links in the show notes about the Tony O'Connor documentary and Sean's talk, because they're both pretty valuable pieces of video.
Yeah, Sean does a great job of, I guess, telling the story of the 8 through his lens.
Yeah.
When I went into the pier, Sean stayed in the 8. And so he experienced lower lows than I did, even though I had injuries. And that Tony Docker's brilliant as well. Tony's an exceptional human. Didn't really talk about him today, but
we talk about him plenty in the Docker, so that's good.
Yeah.
Nice, Michael. Thank you very much. Where do people find you? Are you pretty out there?
Yeah, Instagram for me. You'll probably find me on Michaela's TikTok as well. I'll be firing up the LinkedIn this year. I'm looking to tell my story a bit more, similar to Sean, and do a bit more speaking, hopefully, and share the story.
Wicked.
So in the next couple of months, I'll be trying to be a bit more active on LinkedIn.
Yeah. Where did you do Unyoked?
That's where I proposed to Michaela.
Oh, right. Mm. Yeah.
In August last year. Unyoked has been great. They've actually just gifted us a few stays, which has been really, nice. Really cool. We did one out by Waihee. That was awesome. They had a nice hot tub out there, and it's just in the middle of the bush. It's dead quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And very off the grid. That's their whole vibe. For anyone that doesn't know Unyoked, it's get away from the busyness of life, switch off. The two times I've gone, the second time was the engagements, but the first time I put my phone on the shelf, and it's the first time I think in probably almost 10 years that I haven't touched my phone for 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And just put the phone down, and geez, it was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we did Waihee and we did the engagement one in Raglan.
Nice.
Yeah, which was overlooking the coast. It was beautiful.
Fantastic. So my last question then, Michael, and you probably need it because you've done some mind-numbing things. What keeps you in flow? What do you have a mantra or a way you live your life or a quote or something that shows up when things are going well or if you're in a tough spot, you call on it?
What keeps me in flow? It's relatively simple for me. I thought it was complicated for a long time. But what keeps me in flow is actually just checking things off.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really a to-do lister and a checklister, and even I've been working on my my habits lately, and specifically daily habits, and I'll checklist them. I find when I'm in a bit of a hole, and had a bit of that after sport, as a lot of people do when they're transitioning from one area to another. I found that the habits and my to-dos and anything checklisted was one of the best things for getting me out of what do you call the opposite of flow state, out of a funk into something, because I'd start writing down easy things,
mm-hmm.
and I might be able to check off even my daily habits now, like the first four things on my daily habits are I can check them off within a minute,
mm-hmm.
and it just starts the day. I've ticked off four things and I feel good about it and I'm away. But then when I'm really in flow state, I've got my big things and having the checklist structures done, and then I go, okay, that's what I have to do. And if it feels a bit overwhelming or complex, then I break a big point into a bunch of smaller points. And I don't know why, I get a lot out of doing. And so being able to tick something off gives me that feeling that I've done something, so that kind of keeps me in my flow state.
Brilliant. Thanks, Michael. We'll wrap that up.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers.